Welcome to What Are You Reading, a podcast dedicated to leadership development through commitment to reading.
Hello, and thanks for listening to this episode of DoD Reads, What Are You Reading? I'm your host, Brian Whitmire, and I'm honored to welcome General Retired George W. Casey Jr. to the show. General Casey is an accomplished leader and authority on strategic leadership. He served in the U.S. Army for 41 years, 15 of those years as a general officer serving in senior leadership positions in Europe, the Middle East, and the United States. Before retiring in 2011, General Casey served as the 36th Chief of Staff of the Army for 4 years, where he restored balance to a war-weary force and led the transformation to keep the Army relevant in the 21st century. Today, General Casey lectures on leadership at the S.C. Johnson College of Business at Cornell University and international relations at the Corbell School in Denver. He also serves on numerous corporate boards and boards of organizations that support our servicemen and women, our veterans, and their families. General Casey, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show.
No, great. Nice to be with you, Brian.
Yeah. All right, sir. So the first question we always ask our guests is for every episode is, what are you reading?
So I have Rick Atkinson's, the first book of Rick Atkinson's trilogy on the Revolutionary War. And it's called The British Are Coming. And I'm just about, I'm in the summer of 1776, where Washington is getting ready to get kicked off of Long Island, out of New York, and chased across New Jersey. But I thoroughly enjoy this. He gets into the depth and the details, and I'm learning things about the revolution that I'd never heard before. So it's really, really a fascinating book. Interesting. I took a break because the new Mitch Rapp book came out, and I don't know if your listeners listen to any Mitch Rapp, but he's a CIA rep that goes around the world killing terrorists, and so it's interesting. Since I've retired, I actually started reading fiction. I never used to read fiction. It was always history or biography or autobiography and things like that. But I was coming back from Australia and I didn't have a book. And my wife put me onto this great a book about bioterrorism. And I got into that and I got consumed by it. So it was I'd actually now at the point where I'd rather read something than watch television.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good place to be. I definitely enjoyed fiction a lot more when I was younger. Similar vein to Mitch Rapp. I haven't read his, but Clive Cussler's.
Yeah, books.
Right. I don't know if you read any of his. I mean, they're definitely for a younger audience, but I would read those like almost in one sitting. They just drew me in. They're great books.
Yeah, right.
Great. So what brought you to the Rick Atkinson's trilogy? Have you read it before?
I know him. And, you know, he did that wonderful trilogy on World War II. And he told me he was working on this book, on these books on the Revolution. I admire his work. He's a great historian. And he's got all the logistical records. I mean, he tells you how many flints and how many pounds of powder and everything that Washington had on a given day.
That's great. That's super impressive. So I want to kind of pivot from reading, but kind of stay in that vein and ask, obviously you are a leader with a ton of experience and you're taking that leadership experience to teach others on leadership. But I wanted to ask through your career, if there's any major books or articles that impacted your leadership or your philosophy on leadership, and if so, if you could share those with us.
Yeah, and this may sound a little off, but when I was a brigadier, I was going to Capstone, and we were going to see the Panama Canal in one of our stops, and so I picked up David McCullough's book, Path Between the Seas. And it's a wonderful story about strategic leadership. And on the one hand, you have Ferdinand de Lesseps, who's the great engineer. You know, he's built the Suez Canal, and he's decided that he is so talented he can build this path between the seas across the isthmus in Panama without really getting much time on the ground and supervising anything. And he needs investment, so he sells it to the people of France, and he collects a huge amount of money. And I think, as you know, the whole effort failed. It was ground to halt by disease and failed engineering. And then that's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have Theodore Roosevelt, who realizes that if we're going to be a global power in the United States, we need a way to move our fleets from one ocean to the other. And so he decides that we need to do this. He pays the French $10 million for the canal, and then gets some great army engineers in there and some great army doctors to solve the disease problems, the yellow fever problems, and he succeeds. And I actually would give the book to new brigadiers because it's really, you know, that's really at the level where you switch from being an operational level leader to being a strategic level leader. And it's a big jump, and people don't appreciate the jump that it is.
Yeah, definitely. I can attest to the jump of it. I mean, just going from the tactical level, and then in my position now, or in the next 6 months going to the Pentagon, it's just such a disparity of experience I feel like I have to be, I guess, valid in that position. But
once you served on the joint staff, it completely changes your perspective on things, and you'll benefit for the course of your career.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. So obviously you've served for 41 years. Did your leadership philosophy change at all during that time? Or I guess did it grow? It would probably be a better question.
It has to grow. I mean, it has to grow if you're going to continue to succeed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you move from the direct to the organizational to the strategic levels of leadership, it requires different skills at different levels. And what I found was that as I moved to a different position and moved among the different levels, every time I did that, I'd have to sit down and say to myself, okay, are the skills that got you here the same skills that are going to get you there? In other words, were the skills that made me a good battalion commander going to make me a great brigade commander? Mm-hmm. And the answer was no. Yeah. And so, you know, I had to adapt. And it's interesting that this is probably the biggest change that I had to make. You know, up until battalion command, everybody told me, keep your head down, stay inside your own organizations. Don't worry about what's going on around you. Make your organization as good as it could be. And that's what I did. Then you get up to the brigade level and, you know, you're dealing with battalion commanders who are about your own age, who you don't see as regularly as you did the company commanders that you saw down at battalion level. And so you have to think differently about how you reach them and how you communicate with them and how you communicate priorities through someone else's or your priorities through someone else's organization. And then there's the realization that you need to interact with people outside your organization more at that level than you did at battalion level. And you know, all of a sudden, as a brigade commander, you're dealing with generals. You know, your raider is the assistant division commander or the deputy commander. Mm-hmm. And so now you've got to keep generals involved, and they're kind of a different animal. and the higher I got in different in the organization, in the Army, the more I realized that the keys to my success lay more outside the organization than they did inside. And so I had to spend more time outside the organization, influencing people outside of my direct control to do things that would benefit my organization. And sure. that was a big change.
Sure. It sounds like if you had to put at least one word to something that is crucial through all those positions is adaptability.
Sure.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but.
No. You said, you asked me, how my leadership style changed. I mean, your leadership style has to change and grow over time. Lieutenant Casey didn't lead the same way as General Casey did. And if you don't grow and adapt, you're just not going to be successful.
Well, you've definitely seen a lot of success. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, one more question on focus kind of on reading. Do you have a favorite book?
Really, if I had a favorite book, I'd have to say it was Path Between the Seas.
Nice.
I really enjoyed that. Enjoy that.
Two for one. Mm-hmm. All right. I've prepared for this episode for a while now, and you do extensive talks on VUCA leadership. And I just wanted to give you the opportunity to explain that. I know you've done it a ton of times, but explain that to our audience in case they haven't heard it.
Sure. When I was in Iraq, what I saw is a very good and competent organization, the Army and the Marine Corps, thrust into a fundamentally different environment than we had prepared for. I tell people that I spent 30 years of a 40-year career training to fight a war I never fought, that against the Warsaw Pact in Europe, and the last 10 learning to fight a different kind of war while I was fighting it. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of churn during that period. And I came back to be the Army chief. I was struggling with ways to describe that world. And I got a call from the dean of the Kenan Flagler Business School, and she said, "Will you come talk to our folks here on leading in a VUCA world?" And I hung up, and I said, "Sure." Then I hung up. I immediately Googled VUCA, and to my chagrin and surprise, I found out it was a term coined by the Army War College, 1989, to describe what the world would look like after the demise of the Soviet Union: volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And I realized that was the world that I saw in Iraq. And I started thinking about, okay, how does volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity, how does that impact leaders today? And then what are the skills that it takes to overcome VUCA and lead organizations successfully? And I actually started teaching the things that I had learned in Iraq about leading at the strategic level to generals, because I came back and I immediately revamped the entire general officer development program and put in a new course where I sent generals down to business school in North Carolina for a week. And I would go down and I'd have dinner with them Friday night, and then I'd spend half a day with them on Saturday morning and talk about how to lead in this new and crazy world that we've all been thrust into after September 11th. Hmm. So that's what VUCA is. The whole VUCA is just a way to describe the environment. And it triggered me to think about then, okay, well, what's it take to lead successfully today?
Right. Okay. So I got to ask, what does it take?
Oh, you took the bait.
Yeah. You set me right up.
Yeah. So vision, courage, character, and an offensive mindset. Those are the four things that I think it takes to lead successfully today. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say a couple of words about each of them.
Please.
Vision. If you're going to lead successfully today, you've got to point the way ahead. I mean, that's the number one responsibility of a leader at any level. Is to look at the situation, assess it, and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. I mean, it starts with, what are you going to do now, Lieutenant? They put you through in the basic course. Mm-hmm. But over time, your vision, your ability to see things that others don't can and should grow. And for me, it can all be boiled down to one question, and that is, what are we really trying to accomplish here? And it's a question that can be asked at any level, but it's a question I ask more than any other question in Iraq and again in the Pentagon as the Army Chief. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a simple question, but the higher I got in the organizations, the clearer I had to be able to answer that question, because, you know, nothing got clearer as it left my headquarters and began trickling its way down through the many layers of the chain of command. Mm-hmm. So if it wasn't somewhat clear coming out of my headquarters, folks on the ground didn't have a chance. So vision, the ability to see around corners, to see something significant about the future that other people don't necessarily see. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. Second is courage. You know, Churchill used to say that courage is first among virtues because it empowers all the others. And that's true. Mm. And if you're going to succeed today, you have to act in the swirl of all of this, the VUCA things that are going on around you. And that it takes courage to act with conviction in the face of uncertainty and risk. Mm-hmm. And to succeed today, you have to act. Mm-hmm. And you have to act in that swirl of events. Third is character. I don't have to tell you this. You live it just like I do. But leaders with strong values build strong organizations. And, you know, and from the day you walk in the Army, the seven Army values are instilled in you. Mm-hmm. Loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, and personal courage. And every leader in the Army is held accountable. Every person in the Army is held accountable to those values. And, you know, I do a lot of things with businesses and with MBA students. And, and I said, look, you need to understand that character builds trust, and trust is the glue that holds the organization together. And I tell them to think about the men and women that have led them. And think about the ones that were men and women of character. Then I say, now think about the ones that weren't. And they get it. You know, everybody is looking at you. You know, like one of my predecessors as the Army Chief is Creighton Abrams. And he used to say, the higher up the flagpole you go, the more your butt hangs out. And what he meant by that was, obviously, the higher you are in the organization, the more people are watching you. And if you're not living the values that you espouse, the only one that doesn't know it is you, because everybody else sees you for the phony that you are.
100%.
Yeah. And lastly is this offensive mindset. And, you know, when I first got to Iraq, the situation there was overwhelming. I mean, it was VUCA plus, and it was the most volatile, uncertain, complex environment that I had ever been in. And frankly, before or since. I mean, for me at that time, it was more than COVID. But I think a lot of my students and the businesses that I talk to, the whole COVID experience is probably the most VUCA thing that they've lived through. And you know, what I said to the troops that came in, I'd say, look, I want you to focus on the enemy and be opportunistic. Because I was afraid that if they didn't focus opportunistically on the enemy, that they would get cowed by the environment and get on their back foot. And you're not going to be successful today if you're on your back foot. So I say, to build an offensive mindset, it takes four things. It takes humility. It takes accepting the VUCA paradox. It takes doing your homework. And it takes continuous assessment and adaptation. And I'll just take a couple quick words about that. You know, I don't know if you've seen it, but in the latest Army leadership manual, they added humility as one of the characteristics that the Army wants in its leaders. And, you know, that might sound a bit incongruous to folks to have, how is humility the start of an offensive mindset? But for me, you have to have the humility to accept the fact that we are all human and we can't read people's minds, and we can't predict the future. And there will always be things that we won't know, in fact, that we can never know. But we still have to act. And what I found was the higher I got up in the Army, the more complex the situations became, and the more I realized that I didn't know. And I'll tell you, I probably wasn't comfortable sitting in a meeting and saying, I don't know the answer to that question, probably until I was a colonel or a brigadier general. You know, as you're coming up as a young officer, you're always, you know, you're always doing your homework, and you always have all the answers, right? But the reality is, you really don't know. So humility. Second is you have to accept the VUCA paradox. And Jim Collins, the American leadership guru who wrote Great by Choice, he looked at 20,400 companies. And he looked for companies that outperformed the industry by 10 times out of that 20,400. He found seven. And one of the things all seven of those leaders had in common was they accepted the VUCA paradox. They accepted the fact that their environment would be volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, but they didn't accept the fact that external factors would determine their results. They imposed their will on the environment. Now, did they succeed every time? No. But did they succeed 90% of the time and better? Yeah. Yeah, they did. So accept that. Accept the fact your environment's going to be VUCA. You're not going to change that. That's the reality that we live in. But you can still succeed in that environment if you impose your will on it. Third is you got to do your homework. When I went to Iraq, one of my old deputies gave me a Sun Tzu calendar. So every day I had a new Sun Tzu quote. And one of the ones that really stuck with me was one that said, enlightened leaders make decisions with a clear mind and a pure heart. And that's how that's how I tried to make decisions. I made it with a clear mind that I went out and I gathered as much information as I could. I encouraged diverse opinions from different sectors. I did everything I could to get the most current and best information available, because I was making decisions, putting men and women's lives at risk. And I had to be able to look myself in the mirror and say, look, I did everything humanly possible to get the best information I could. And if I could do that, then I could say, okay, I did my homework. The second part of it, though, is pure heart. I also had to be able to look myself in the mirror at the end of the day and say, I'm doing this for the right reasons, because it's the right thing to do for the organization to accomplish our mission, even though I'm putting people at risk.
Yeah.
And so in the end, if I could say I did it, I'm making this decision with a clear mind and a pure heart, it gave me the conviction that the plan might work. And that gave me the courage to act in the swirl of events. You know, I don't know if they still say this in the Army, but when I was coming up, they used to say that there's only two kinds of plans, those that might work and those that won't work. Mm-hmm. And because we're human, the best we're going to do is a plan that might work. Yeah. And so, like I said, if I could build the conviction that the plan might work, that gave me the courage to act. And then lastly, you have to continuously assess and adapt. You know, think about it. If the best you're going to do is a plan that might work, and as von Moltke said, no plan survives first contact with the enemy, you know it's going to change. So why are we surprised? Mm-hmm. So the question is not, is the plan going to change? The question is, are you going to be ready to take advantage of it when it happens?
Right.
And that requires continuous assessment and adaptation. Anyway, so that's the basis of the offensive mindset. And that's a very, very long-winded answer to the what's it take to lead today. But there you go.
No, but it's all valuable and it's all applicable to the VUCA world. It's interesting. I'm taking a public leadership class now. And one of the points was brought up that before you act, you must first understand. And in a VUCA world, you honestly, I don't think you can truly understand everything. You have to get to a point where you know enough to act, and then you need to not delay in action.
And then you act, assess, adapt, and continue. You go, you know, we're human nature doesn't like change. You know, we like square corners. We like to know what we're doing every day. But you need a fundamentally different mindset today. Again, you have to accept the reality your environment is going to be VUCA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's never going to change, whether it's COVID or Iraq or whatever. It's there's
right. whatever's next. Mm-hmm. Yeah, whatever's next.
Yeah. You touched on a couple of where I wanted to guide the conversation already. I really appreciate that. But I mean, I have to admit, I had to pick my jaw up off the floor after I was reading your full bio, joining the Army in 1970. Serving 41 years just seems unsurmountable to this lowly 10-year captain. So,
my original plan was to do my 2-year ROTC obligation and get out and go to law school. So things don't always go the way you think.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Uncle Sam. Right?
Yeah,
That's great. But just I can't imagine the things you saw, how you saw the Army culture grow and develop and change through those 41 years. One of the most recent ones, or you already mentioned, like adding humility to their doctrine on leadership and of a key trait. I think that's important. And having certain leadership attitude is important to be a good leader. Are there any other ways you saw the Army culture or the leadership culture in the Army change during your time serving?
Yeah. I mean, probably this is the biggest change that I saw. And, you know, I came in, I got to my first unit in Germany in April of 1971. And so we were drawing down in Vietnam, but the war was still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we, at that time, the Army adopted a business manufacturing practice called zero defects. And, you know, it made sense from a manufacturing perspective to have a culture where people were focused on having no defects in the whatever it was they were manufacturing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like we do with a lot of things in the Army, we took it to in extremes. And I always, I don't know this, but I always thought that you know, we felt the loss of what we perceived to be the loss of the war in Vietnam. And so we wanted to be best, you know, we wanted to demonstrate to ourselves that we were still really good. So when zero defects came along, what that got translated into in the Army was everything has to be 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And it really drove folks in a wrong direction. And I can remember as a company commander, you know, the expectation was that I would have 100% qualification in weapons, and you know, everything was 100%. And anybody mm-hmm. who's dealt with 100 people knows that you never get 100% with people. It's just that's the way it is. And it wasn't really until we started going to the National Training Center and we got shocked out of it, where I remember as a major going out there with my battalion. I was the XO, and Colonel Shackelford and Lieutenant Colonel Larry Word were the two folks in charge, and they got us all out on top of Arrowhead Hill, and they told us that we were the dumbest SOBs they'd ever seen, and they didn't know how we got a commission. but that was a wake up call. Mm-hmm. And it was a realization that look, you're never going to be zero defects, but you got to learn how to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that really kind of got, in my view, among other things, is one of the main things that got the Army moving in the right direction. And what we did with the non-commissioned on officer corps training and things like that was probably the other thing. But that was a huge change, you know. And then we get thrust into the wars after September 11th. And, you know, one of the things about combat is that it forces you to decentralize, because there's so much going on that as a leader, you can't micromanage everything, mm-hmm. even though I'm sure there's still a few people out there to try. and so, you know, we moved from zero defects to mission command. And you know what I worried about as the chief, and I actually in 2010 I got all of the 3-star commanders and sergeants major into Washington, and I said, look, I want to be careful about going back to what I said, the chicken shit army of the early 70s. Mm-hmm. That zero defects army. I said, we'll drive people out if we allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. And so we need to stick with the mission command and broad orders. And, you know, the thing about mission command is that it forces the leader to think and to really work until you can provide clear direction. Mm-hmm. I people always talk about empowerment, and I say, no, look, empowerment's right, but it's got to be focused empowerment. You can't just look at Lieutenant Whitmer and say, go out there, Brian, and this is what I want you to do, and come back and tell me when you're done. You know, if you want them to succeed, you make sure that they understand what it is you want them to do, that they have the resources that they want them to do, and you give them the opportunity to come back and calibrate them as you're going along. So, you know, people always say you need to encourage failure, and I, you know, that never quite sat right for me. I like to let them go till they almost hit the floor, and then kind of come in at the last minute and say, well, what about this? So that they get the sense of failure, but they don't quite fall completely on their face.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. I can attest to the mission command philosophy and just how beneficial this is from putting the onus on the junior leaders to not just be a mindless cog in a machine, but to really understand and have the freedom to provide feedback, bottom up refinement and operate within the margins of the commander's intent above them, instead of just, you know, marching in step.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I saw in Iraq and even among some senior leaders is, and I don't say this negatively just as a reality, but, you can get to the point where you don't act because you're afraid of making a mistake. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have to be able to get past that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's true. And it takes leaders to make that decision too. Mm-hmm. Well, you shared so much already about your career. I was wondering, is there anything from your experience, whether it was a success or a failure, that makes the biggest lasting impression on you, or the one you revisit in your mind often, that you care to share with us?
Well, you know, when I saw that question, it caused me to reflect on what I brought with me into the military. Hmm. Because, you know, our a lot of our character is shaped by the time we raise our right hands. Mm-hmm. And I remember two things that really stuck with me as a young officer and as a young person. Was one, my grandfather was a businessman, a warehouseman up in Boston. And he took me aside one day and was giving me mentoring and guidance. And he said, George, never forget, you're no better than anyone, but no one's better than you. So treat everyone with respect, but don't take any guff from anybody. Hmm. And really more than any one thing, that really shaped the way I dealt with people, which shaped the way that I led. You know, treated everybody with respect until they proved they didn't deserve it, and then, you know, stand up for what you believe in. And then the second bit of advice that really shaped my leadership style was from my dad, and he was a great athlete in high school, about 3-sport athlete, was captain of the West Point hockey team. Never could make that little white ball go where he wanted it to go, but it was one of the frustrations of his life. But he said, George, never be afraid to try to be the very best. And I didn't really appreciate the try part of it until after a while. But what I realized was that by trying to be the best and by trying to make your organization the best that it can be, you'll achieve more than would have been possible. Mm-hmm. And that if you reach high and stretch yourself, you may not get all the way to the goal that you're achieving, but you'll be so much better than if you didn't cause yourself to stretch. Mm-hmm. So those were really two things that shaped my leadership style.
Yeah. And especially if you take into the other, I mean, if you put them together and you treat everyone with respect while you're trying to achieve the best you can be and be the best, all you're going to do is make those people around you that you're treating with respect better as well. Because it's easy, you know, when you're trying to be the best, everyone's going to see you as, you know, only caring about being the best and not about those around you. But when you balance it by, you know, applying that first principle from your grandfather, of treating them with respect, then they know that you're just trying to make everyone better. You know, not just there right. in it for your own reasons.
Yeah. And frankly, what I found over the course of my career is people want to be part of an organization at the best at what they do. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're generally just, most people aren't disciplined enough to do it by themselves, but they can do it as part of a team.
Yeah.
And that's what you do. That's what you do as a leader.
Yeah. Yeah. You get a group of individuals to accomplish things that they wouldn't normally do by mm-hmm. themselves. Yeah. Okay. So I'd like to pivot a little bit from your 41 years of outstanding service to kind of focusing on anything you might've learned as a continued improvement in the last 10 years. So is there anything that you've learned there, the education realm or your positions in the board of directors that has better developed you as a leader?
Honestly, I think the idea of the essentiality of humility in leaders today. Mm-hmm. And I co-taught a class at Darden in their executive MBA program, University of Virginia Business mm-hmm. School, with Professor Ed Hess. And he had written a book called Humility, the essential, I think it's a subtitle, is the essential virtue for today, for today's leaders. And I got to admit, I was kind of, what's this about, you know? And so I read it, and then we kept talking as I worked the course, and I realized the essentiality of it. And, you know, it's just the fact that if you accept the fact going in up front, again, that I said, you can't read people's mind, you can't predict the future, and there's always going to be things that you can't or won't know. For me, it makes it easier to deal with, you know, and it still allows me to stretch high and to try to, you know, make my organization the best I can make it. But at the same time, I don't go into deep depression because I didn't quite get as high as I thought I could. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, what I said this earlier, but, you know, the higher I went in the organization, the more I realized I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And couldn't know. And, you know, I had to be able to admit that.
Yeah.
But so it's so I think that's probably the thing that I've come to grips with since I left the Army. And it you know, what I found was I did a lot of things just naturally. And, you know, when you treat everybody with dignity and respect, while you're trying to make an organization the best you can, it takes some humility to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And even though I didn't know that at the time, I didn't call it that at the time, if you understand what I'm talking about.
Sure.
And so, you know, for example, as a battalion commander and as a brigade commander and division commander, I didn't really talk to people about humility and about that being important. Now I talk about it in every class.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, just in the short time I've been in the military, humility has definitely been a vein that's come to the surface, as well as I think just transparency in line with that and being approachable as leaders. Some, I know when I mean, it's only been 10 years, but a lot of my first leaders, you know, kind of put on a tough face or an outer exterior But I think it's being more acceptable to be a little more human as a leader and approachable and real to your subordinates. And I think that that just carries a lot of weight in the formations today.
Yeah. You know, you said transparency, but I kind of, I call that candor.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that goes hand in hand with humility for a leader.
100%. You know, yeah.
Troops aren't dumb.
Mm-hmm.
They know when you put lipstick on a pig. In my first platoon chart, and I'd screwed something up, and I said, my platoon chart, I said it, sergeant Drummond, I'm going to, you know, I could get the platoon together because I want to tell him it was my fault. I screwed this up. He said, oh, sir, you can't do that. You can never admit to the men you made a mistake. I said, why? They know.
Yeah.
And I just found candor important. Nothing, you know, things aren't going to go well all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, If you want people to be open with you and to tell you when you slip a showing, you got to be willing to say my slip showing.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's so valuable and so important today. Mm-hmm. So I know you sit on, I can't count how many boards of directors you sit on as a member, but you are the chairman of the board of directors for the USO. And I know it's been a tough year for the world, obviously the last year and a half, but how is the USO kind of applied, or how are they adapting to the VUCA world that we're living in today to meet the needs of our service members and their families?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you asked that because, you know, we're working through something here with over the last couple of months, but saying, you know, how have we changed over the 20 years of war?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been significant. Honestly, on September 11th, the USO was almost bankrupt. We had no reserves, and a couple of board members had to write checks so that we could actually make a payroll.
Wow.
And we were airports and USO shows. That was us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as the needs of the men and women of the armed forces and their families have changed so fundamentally over the last 20 years, we've grown and adapted with them. And we took on a maxim several years ago to be always beat by their side. Mm-hmm. So from the time that a serviceman or woman walks into the MEP station, probably in a good almost half of the MEP stations around the United States, they're going to see a USO banner and be able to access the USO. To the time they walk out the door, and we started actually a transition program. And the USO is focused on our servicemen and women, but we didn't feel that if we didn't help them transition back into civilian life, that, you know, we weren't meeting fully what it is that we needed to do for them. And then the third big thing I think we've done is we've added a significant amount of family programs to what we're doing, with the recognition that families are a huge part of the all volunteer force.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you have family programs, and we still do airports. And we still do USO shows, although last year's Christmas special in COVID was to Dina Menzel, and it was all Zoomed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're expanding into area like video games. And, you know, the idea that you can have a bunch of executives from a company or a bunch of people from a company sit down and play video games with a group of servicemen and women deployed in Korea or Okinawa or whatever.
That's
so
great.
We're working on all that. And then lastly, we've just gone through a major restructuring. We 3 years ago, there were 18 different 501c3s in the USO. So 18 independent charities, wow, all with the name of USO.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't share. Mm-hmm. They took care of their area. And it was very inefficient. And we had places that could raise a lot of money, like the New York area, but had no troops. And we had places like Norfolk that had a whole lot of troops, but couldn't raise a lot of money. And so we had to sort that out. And we've just completed that. Everybody's under one roof now. And we're really setting ourselves up for the 21st century. And the last part of that, this enables us now, we've also gone to five regions across the United States. So we're able to not only reach more of our military, but also to reach the Guard and Reserve as they're deployed on for things like hurricane relief and flood relief and things like that.
Yeah.
And so we're in a position now where not only we can reach more of our troops and their families, but we can also give the American people more of an opportunity to connect with our servicemen and women so that they get a better understanding of what they do. Mm-hmm. And so, so, you know, you're always as a leader trying to prepare the organization for success in the future, right? Because that's where success exists. What I tell the business folks is your last quarterlies are history, right? It's a leader's job to prepare the organization for success in the future.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're doing with the USO.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I'm so encouraged that you're taking everything you've learned to continue to apply to help our service members and their families and continue to adapt. Because I mean, obviously it's a need, that needs to be met. And you're standing in the void to do it. So I just appreciate that, a lot, especially since I now have a military family of my own.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, sir, I really appreciate your time. Do you have any final thoughts, or words of wisdom you'd like our audience to take away?
Just think about that offensive mindset. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about you imposing your will on your competition and the environment and creating the future you want through action. That's vision, courage, character, and that offensive mindset. That's what it takes to succeed today. Good luck.
Awesome. Great. Sir, thank you so much for your time and sharing your wisdom and insight on leadership. And with our audience, and we just, I just want to extend my appreciation for your lifetime of service to our country and the servicemen and women and their families. So thank you.
Well, my pleasure and best of luck to you, Brian.
All right. Thank you, sir.
A box of books is like a care package for your brain. If your command library is looking a bit shabby, DoD Reads can help. We are connected to multiple organizations that would be glad to send your command free books, magazines, and high-quality reading material. Head over to dodreads.com and check out our featured article, 8 Ways to Request Free Books for Your Command, and then let us know, what are you reading?
Thanks for listening to this episode of What Are You Reading?, a podcast produced through partnership with DoD Reads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share it. Leave us a comment with your answer to the question, what are you reading? Also, visit dodreads.com for free books, book reviews, interviews with your favorite authors, and many more free professional development resources. See you next week.